Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young.
We're in a critical time now where like millions of acres of farmland is going to change hands.
On this week's show, we take a look at farmland transitions. As the farming population ages, who will take the reins? We've got farmers hanging up their hats with no one to take over the family farm, and we've got young people anxious to get started farming with no land to call their own. We sit in on a workshop with Mary Swander, helping farmers map out their heart's desire for the future of their land. And we talk with two guys who worked out a sweet land deal just a few miles outside of town. Harvest Public Media reports on meat consumption trends, and Chef Daniel Orr gets us started with a recipe for some of the earliest wild edibles. That's all coming up on Earth Eats. First up, we've got some news. Hey, Alex.
Hey, Kate.
You know, I've been wondering, what's going on in the world of tree crops? Any chance you've got some news about that?
I thought you might be wondering about tree crops. I do have news on that. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. Good for honeybees, but bad for forests.
All right, let's hear it.
Almonds are everywhere these days. Along with your standard raw almonds, you can get roasted almonds, salted almonds, almond milk, almond butter, almond flour. I could go on. Most almonds are grown in California's Central Valley, where the hot, dry climate is ideal for the trees. The U.S. produces 10 times as many as the EU and exports about two-thirds of the crop to other countries. The demand for some almond products has tripled in the past decade, and this year the U.S. had a record harvest at just over 2 billion pounds. But the almond industry has faced some challenges, a Bloomberg article reminded us this week. In 2011, when almonds gained a reputation during a multi-year drought as an especially thirsty crop, there were calls for consumers to cut back on their almond habits. It's easy to make the case that almonds' 1 gallon per nut water ratio makes the crop a double-edged sword. But almonds are the economic backbone of California's agriculture industry, and their continued production almost single-handedly helped honeybee colonies rebound across the country after the mysterious colony collapse disorder began killing bees at alarming rates in 2006. The almond industry is the single biggest user of commercial pollination services in the country, and production is expected to continue to soar in the U.S. in the next few years. While oversupply can mean growers lose money, cheaper prices on almond products could make consumers want even more. The almond industry is expecting a 2.8 billion pound harvest next year. That's a lot of almonds. Almonds aren't the only tree crops in the news these days. An environmental group reports that about 9 square miles of forest was cleared in Indonesian Papua since November last year, a sign that the tightly controlled province could become a new frontier for oil palm plantations. Papua has about a third of Indonesia's remaining rainforest, but tree cover in the remote province has been shrinking over the last 5 years. Satellite imagery shows that the amount of cleared land more than tripled between 2011 and 2016. The Indonesian half of New Guinea, known as West Papua, has a long history of being exploited for natural resources. It has the world's largest gold mine and the second largest copper mine, the Grasberg Mine, which is owned by the Freeport-McMoRan Company in Phoenix, Arizona. Environmental groups in Indonesia say agribusinesses have been eyeing Papua's uncut wilderness since the 2008 economic crisis spurred calls for better food security. The groups warn that the latest effort is merely a pretext to clear land with valuable hardwood and expand lucrative oil palm plantations. Concerns about deforestation led to Norway's central bank divesting from a parent company tied to the recent clearing. 20 international companies pledged to exclude the company, POSCO Daewoo, from its supply chains. In response, the company has announced a temporary moratorium on new clearing. But satellite data shows that other companies with oil palm concessions continue to clear land. Thanks to Taylor Killow and Chad Bouchard for those reports.
Thank you, Alex.
Sure thing, Kate.
When two big meat companies, Tyson and Cargill, recently invested in a lab-grown protein startup, some said Americans' love affair with meat had cooled. Actually, it's quite the opposite. The U.S. is expected to consume a record amount of red meat and poultry this year. Harvest Public Media's Peggy Lowe reports that the reasons are both healthy and not so healthy.
Here in Kansas City, one of the newer restaurants downtown is called Protein House. Alexander Minelli just had a Greek bowl delivered to his table.
So it's a turkey burger with brown rice, some low-fat feta cheese, like a salad, but it's a Mediterranean salad because you can see there's olives.
Minelli is a bodybuilder and says he came to Protein House because he eats what he calls clean food, like turkey produced without antibiotics. He and other healthy eaters are helping drive record meat consumption. The U.S. Agriculture Department estimates that each one of us, on average, will consume more than 220 pounds of beef, pork, chicken, or turkey this year.
We are a nation of protein eaters.
David Portolatin is an analyst with NPD Group, a global firm that tracks consumer behavior. He says 56% of consumers named protein as the top nutrient they are looking to add to their diet. Portolatin via Skype says there's no one big fad diet right now, though most are eating something low carb, like paleo or keto diets. He says American adults are embracing a very personalized sense of health.
Among consumers that tell us that they are following a specific diet, the most popular diet in America today is simply one of my own making.
His research shows that consumers don't really like typical diet definitions either. Take a guy like Thomas Donnelly, who was waiting for his lunch at Protein House. He ordered a hummus wrap, as he says he mostly stays away from meat, sort of.
I typically do, but then I'll go have barbecue on the weekends every now and then.
Donnelly says he doesn't like labels like vegetarian or flexitarian. Those are folks who eat mostly vegetables with some meat thrown in. That makes sense to David Sprinkle, a food market researcher with a company called Packaged Facts.
A confusing thing about consumer food trends is that conflicting trends are always at work. Often within the same individual and over the course of the same day.
Although there's lots of talk of vegetarian or vegan diets, Sprinkle says not many people actually follow them. The meat movement, Sprinkle sees, is much more towards traditional and not real healthy dishes.
There is a real celebration of meat of all types. And we've seen that with the pork craze, you know, pulled pork sandwiches, the bacon craze. We're seeing bacon, you know, in our candy bars.
The other big trends are big calorie dishes like gourmet burgers, fried chicken, beef short ribs, and charcuterie. And that's found from high-end restaurants to fast food places.
Somewhere underneath all that bacony, bourbony, crispy oniony goodness, there's a turkey having the best day of his entire life.
Arby's, we have the meat.
And there's another factor at play. U.S. supplies of red meat and chicken are at record highs, thanks to a grain glut, so prices at the grocery store are low. And the more cheap meat, the more you eat. The USDA recommends that adults eat 5 to 6 ounces of protein daily, but it also forecasts we'll consume double that every single day this year. Peggy Lowe, Harvest Public Media.
Support for Harvest Public Media comes from this station and from the Center for Great Plains Studies at the University of Nebraska, host of April's Conservation and Tourism Conference, Plain Safaris in Kearney, Nebraska. Learn how tourism can save our natural environment and help communities grow. More at go.unl.edu/tourism.
Check out harvestpublicmedia.org for more reporting on agriculture and rural life.
Thank you. Production support comes from Charles Schwab & Company, Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Needmoreroasters.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net.
My great-great-grandfather farmed 2,000 acres here with his brother. He was a huge cattle guy. The railroad spur came up into our property, and he would send cattle to Chicago on that. The track was taken out in the late 1970s, but in dry years, you can still see it. Those 2,000 acres were then divided among their three children.
That's the voice of Mary Swander, reading from a book called The Future of Family Farms. She's reading a letter written by a farmer about the history of his farm.
I am the playwright, the artistic director of Swander Woman Productions that tours agricultural plays throughout the United States.
Mary Swander is also the poet laureate of Iowa and the author of numerous books and plays centered on rural life and the stories of farmers drawn from an oral history tradition.
We are here today in Bloomington for a performance of Map of My Kingdom. That's a play about farmland transition or who's going to get the farm in the end. We've been touring this play now for 3 years. It was originally commissioned by Practical Farmers of Iowa to help families open up a conversation about how they were going to change over hands, generations, help them talk about it because we didn't, you know, traditionally we were good Midwesterners. We didn't talk about anything like this that had money and death attached to it, especially. We're in a critical time now where like millions of acres of farmland is going to change hands. The baby boomers are starting to retire. And so it's, you know, ours is a high population group. If you don't make a plan, oftentimes the farm will be just sucked up into urban sprawl or, you know, a large corporate farm, and it gets sold. There might be heirs that don't care about it, live someplace else, so they just want to cash out.
So farmers are aging. Farmland is changing hands. Some of it will no longer remain farmland. What will be the impact of that? What's at stake?
Nothing works in isolation with farmland. You think, oh, this is just my farm, and if, you know, it's a little farm, if 120 acres, you know, gets used for a housing development, what difference will it make? Or this is 120 acres, if it gets sucked up in a big corporate farm, what difference? Well, that eliminates a family that's not living on that farm, so they're not sending their kids to the school. So without a school, community begins to go downhill and evaporate. It's a family that's not going into town to buy nails and screws and hammers from the local hardware store. So that's an enterprise, a business that goes out of business. So it has a like real reverberating effect. It's way bigger than one family.
Okay, so why don't I start interviewing you, Bob?
Okay, all right.
So tell me where your farm is located and how many acres there are.
Okay, this is a northern part of Monroe County and 200 acres, mostly forested.
In the Legacy Letter Workshop, participants pair up to begin interviewing each other about their farms with a set of questions that Swander provides.
And so that's what the legacy letter is, to just write something down on the paper that your family can then, it's a beginning, start from, talk about, reflect upon, discuss, before you go into that expensive meeting with your lawyer.
It's the first step in a process for retiring farmers to plan for the future of their land. She shares some examples from the book, like the one we started with, where the guy's writing about his great-grandfather, the cattle guy.
The key to making a really evocative letter that somebody's going to read is these details. He talks about the train track and how it was taken out, but you can still see it on a dry day. Isn't that nice? It's just a beautiful image, you know. There's real poetry to this guy.
Swander stresses the importance of a well-written letter, because you want people to read it. If it's just a list of numbers and facts and dates about the land, it might not be compelling enough, and it might not get read. It's also important to convey what really matters to you for the future of your farm. If your heirs understand that you want to see the land continue as farmland, they might take the time to find a buyer who wants to grow food. Or they might choose to keep the land and lease it out to a young farmer who doesn't own land but wants to grow food. These kinds of non-traditional land transfers take time to set up. That's why Mary Swander and Practical Farmers of Iowa are offering these workshops. And they aren't alone. Land transition programs and land link opportunities are offered all across the heartland. Organizations like Young Farmers Coalition, helping young farmers find land to farm, and helping aging farmers find ways to keep their land in production, even if they don't have heirs, or even if their heirs aren't interested in farming. This week, I had the chance to visit with a landowner and a farmer, an unrelated pair, who find themselves engaged in a creative arrangement for sustainable agriculture. John Byers owns some land just a few miles outside of Bloomington, Indiana.
I was raised on a cash grain farm near Lafayette. I never really liked, you know, the way that the land was treated and so forth, you know, intensive chemical inputs. I refer to it as chemical farming. So I wanted to do something different, and I knew I wasn't the one to actually do it.
Enter Grant Pershing.
I had been looking for a farm for 4 or 5 years of my own. What really happened is the bank kind of, I've been farming for 12 years now, and the income is not very good. So the bank viewed me as a pretty poor risk. So I could either find a dilapidated house with enough land or a nice house with no land. When it came down to buying something, it just wasn't able to happen. I came out here and
Byers was open to leasing some of his land for farming.
I just really like the concept of local food, that it's grown within a few miles of where it's consumed.
It seemed ideal to Pershing. Byers' place isn't huge, about 3.5 acres, but plenty of land for the kind of farming he was interested in. And it's close to town, which is important since his partner Molly works in town.
It's much better than paying a mortgage that I couldn't afford and building a house on some land that I had to tear a house down on, you know?
So here's how it works. Byers lives in the house on his land just outside of town. Byers is a carpenter and a contractor, and he owns a few rental properties in Bloomington. Pershing lives with his partner in town, and he farms the land out at Byers' place. They have a long-term lease agreement, 5 years for now, but they say it will be extended.
I have a clause in my will that says that Grant has the right to farm here basically as long as he wants. And, you know, my heirs can sell this property, but it has to be sold with that as a covenant on the deed. I wanted to give him some security that he is putting a lot of sweat equity into this. And he's got structures he's placed here with the hoop houses, and he deserves to have some security to know that he's made a good investment.
Pershing pays a small monthly rent for use of the land, plus utilities. He secured a small farm loan to get started, purchased equipment, supplies, and 2 hoop house structures. They built a walk-in cooler to store the produce
and they're building a barn this year with a produce washing station. Pershing's farm is called Blue Hour Farm. It's a sustainable, organic practice focused on building and maintaining the soil. He grows mostly vegetables, herbs, and flowers, and he runs a 30-share CSA. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. Customers pay a set fee up front at the start of the season when the farmer has the most expenses. Then they receive weekly shares of the produce that's available that week. He sells produce at the farmer's market in Bloomington, and they sell to a couple of small restaurants in town. Blue Hour is a four-season farm, and Grant and Molly have recently started selling their own handcrafted fermented products, such as sauerkraut and kimchi. They'll have a farm stand on site this summer, working on the honor system, and that'll be for neighbors around Buyer's Land to purchase the fresh produce. This year, Pershing is excited about his plans for trellising tomatoes in one of the hoop houses.
I like the smell of tomatoes, the plants, you know, there's just something about that. Pruning an heirloom tomato, getting the sap on your hands, you know, that never comes off, you know. Something about that I really like.
Buyers in Pershing agree that the lease arrangement is working out well for both of them. I ask them what they like most about what they're doing.
When people tell me that how much they like the food, I really like just the idea of growing food for people. I make a living, a meager living, but, you know, farming 12 years, I've learned to live pretty simply. Yeah, I make enough money to pay my bills and have some extra money to go on vacation at the end of the season.
Well, just being out here amongst all this good stuff that's happening, that's the wonderful satisfaction to me. And I really like, you know, just the whole feel of the thing, the way that he laid out the beds. And it was so great to be all around that and see it all being all happening, but not be responsible for it.
We'll share some links on our website for some of the organizations working to connect new farmers looking for farmland with those retiring farmers who are looking to rent or sell their land for continued farming. You'll find that at eartheats.org. It's officially spring. It may or may not feel like that outside your door right now, but as of March 20th, it's official. Gardeners, you're probably looking forward to those first salad greens and radishes. But listen, you could get some fresh greens even before those are ready. Dandelion greens are one of the first things to pop up in most yards, and I'd say the best time to enjoy them is in the early, early spring. The leaves are tiny and tender and not at all bitter. You can enjoy them in a salad without even cooking them. You can also harvest a bunch of leaves and make this great dish that Chef Daniel Orr has for us today. The name dandelion comes from the French dent de lion, or lion's tooth. It refers to the jagged shape of the leaves. They look sort of like sharp teeth. Daniel Orr will show us how to tame this wild lion's tooth leaf, and he starts by heating up a large skillet on the stove.
Okay, we're going to add a little bit of olive oil. You don't need to use your most expensive extra virgin olive oil for this. It's going in at the very beginning of the cooking. You want to save your good extra virgin olive oils for finishing dishes like drizzling over pastas or using in salad dressings, because if you cook those nice green olive oils, you're just going to cook out the flavor. It'll actually evaporate into your exhaust fan. So you're just paying $16 a liter for nothing. So use your less expensive or mixed olive oil for this to get started. What I've done is I've tossed in my local sausage. What we want to do is to cook the sausage until it starts to brown. That way it develops some of the flavor. You want to, anytime you brown meat, it kind of caramelizes the proteins and the sugars, and that's where you get the nice rich flavor. All right, once your sausage has started letting out some of the fat, starting to color, we're going to add some onions. And again, we're going to let those cook for a few minutes. We want them to start to caramelize. The onions will release some sugar. They're very sweet, and especially during the summertime when you can get Vidalia onions and other real sweet varieties of onions, use those for this dish because, again, you're taming the wild beast, the dent de lion. I'm going to season this with a little salt and pepper. And I'm also going to add my garlic at this time. Depending on how much salt is in your sausage, you want to season that way. So taste your sausage, see how spicy it is, how salty it is, and then you can add a little additional seasoning. And the aromas are starting to really come out. I love the smell of cooking onions and garlic. They say that when you're trying to sell your house, you should either roast a chicken or cook a pot of onions, and then it will smell like home. Okay, once that sausage and onions have started to brown, you're gonna add your potatoes. Now, you could do it two ways. You could either put them raw in here and then cook them a little bit longer, or you can do as I did today, and I have a selection of red, white, and blue potatoes that I've par-cooked ahead of time, so it's a little bit quicker cooking method. Okay, I also have a habanero pepper, a small little habanero pepper. Now, this is really spicy, but I love the flavor of it. So what I'm gonna do to get the flavor without the spice is I'm going to add it whole, and then when it gives the flavor that I want, I can just remove it. Okay, and then finally I'm going to add our dandelion greens. I'm just kind of laying those across the top, and that almost forms a little lid over the potatoes and sausage mixture. I'm going to add a little bit of vegetable stock, and we're just going to let that come to a boil and steam for a little while. And we're going to let that stock cook out a little bit. Wait till the potatoes are completely cooked. Again, if you were starting with raw potatoes, it's going to take you 15 to 20 minutes for them to cook. If you use par-cooked potatoes, you're going to have about a 5-minute cooking time. And now we're going to add the acid to the dish. And what we want to do is create what my grandfather called a pot liquor. And that's the juice that's in the bottom of a batch of greens. And we always put a little bit of vinegar. We even kept a cruet of vinegar on the dinner table that you could add to your pot liquor and drink it at the end of the bowl of greens.
You'll find this recipe and some other dishes for dandelions on the Earth Eats website, eartheats.org. Production support comes from The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And need more coffee roasters? A woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers. On Bloomington's east side, corner of Pete Ellis and Longview. Brunch every Sunday from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. Needmoreroasters.com. Thank you to everyone who makes Earth Eats possible. That includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killow, Daniel Orr, Farm Bloomington Restaurant, Indiana University Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Mary Swander, John Byers, and Grant Pershing. Our executive producer is John Bailey. That's it for our show. I'm Kate Young, and thanks for listening to Earth Eats.